me, my coaching staff, we put a huge premium on body language. And if your body language is bad, you will never get in the game. Ever. I don't care how good you are. If somebody says, well, you know, you just benched Stewie for, you know, 35 minutes in the Memphis game a couple years ago. Yeah, I did. Oh, that was to motivate her for the South Carolina game the following Monday. No, it wasn't. Stewie was acting like a 12-year-old. So I put her on the bench and said, sit there. It doesn't matter on our team. Now, the other coaches might say, well, you can do that because you got three other, you know, All-Americans. I get that. I understand that. But I'd rather lose than watch kids play the way some kids play. I'd rather lose. Don't get me started. So when I look at my team, they know this. When I watch game film, I'm checking what's going on the bench. And if somebody's asleep over there, somebody doesn't care, somebody's not engaged in the game, they will never get in the game. Ever. And they know that. They know I'm not kidding.
Coaches, you might recognize that post-game interview from Gino Auriemma at the Final Four a couple of years ago, where he's talking about his players' body language. Now, if you're anything like me, I don't know that it's just that simple to correct a player's body language by putting them on the bench. In fact, if it was, I don't think we'd have any problems with body language ever, because they would sit on the bench and learn. So what we're going to talk about this week are other strategies for helping your players get to the root of what is actually causing that body language, and helping you to have some strategies to give them a mistake recovery system that they can use after their mistakes.
Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nate Sanderson.
In this episode, we discuss practical ideas to help you develop as a coach and build your team's culture. Now, we want to get you out of here in 30 minutes or less, so let's get started.
You're listening to episode 82, Strategies to Help Players Recover from Their Mistakes. So Nate, I think you're spot on there that it's just not that simple. I know in my experience as a coach, there were times where I said, you know what, I'm going to teach them a lesson through the bench, and I would just pull players and yank them anytime they had a negative response to any mistake of theirs. And sadly, I had players that went through my coaching tenure of, you know, spent 4 years with me, and honestly, they really never got much better at that. And I have to reflect on the way that I was coaching, and I definitely wasn't helping them to support them and making some changes in their behavior. I was simply just calling them out consistently, putting them on the bench, and it ended up just creating some real distance in our relationships. And honestly, it's one of the biggest regrets I have in coaching, is that I didn't try to find a better way to do things here than just come in with accountability.
Well, JP, I think one of the things you got to consider is that players don't know what they don't know. In other words, sometimes we assume that if a player has bad body language or they have a negative response to a situation, that they just don't care enough to keep their head up, or they don't care enough to say something positive or to not react in a negative way, when the reality is they don't know how to change their thinking. They don't know how to respond or to make a choice, even if they have an emotional response to what's just happened. You know, if we're teachers of the game, we wouldn't necessarily leave our systems or our defensive concepts to chance and just expect a kid to figure it out. And yet I think too often when it comes to the mental, emotional aspects of the game, like mistake recovery, we just assume that they got to mature, they got to figure it out, it's their responsibility, and if they don't, give me somebody else that can.
So often in my conversations with coaches, it's often their more talented or more skilled player that really kind of struggles in these areas. And I think that's largely based upon that player's experience too, of that type of behavior has been not only tolerated, right? Not only do I think, you know, we get players that really struggle with this, and have they been allowed to respond in that way in previous teams, but I think they turn on the TV and what do they see? They see some of the best players out there when they don't get the call or when things don't go their way. And the way that they show that they care, the way that they show that they're a competitor, is to have this outlandish type of body language behavior and negativity, and then to go into a press conference and to call people out. I mean, just the mistake response from so many of our top athletes out there today just isn't setting a really good example for them.
Well, not only that, but One of the things that the research also says about just how that internal voice is formed from a player is that that inner monologue is shaped most significantly by the voices that they hear most frequently and most intensely. In other words, if they grew up with a parent that was their coach all the way until they got to you in high school, and that parent was critical of every mistake that they made, their inner monologue is trained to react or naturally reacts in the same way that they've heard most frequently throughout their career. And so in some ways, that we have shaped, maybe unknowingly, the way that players respond by simply going straight to accountability. All of a sudden, they just expect, well, I'm not good enough and I can't do it. And, you know, we've reinforced that in the way that they're thinking rather than teaching them some tools and strategies to be able to interrupt that and be able to perform at their best level moving forward.
Yeah, and so that's what we're going to kind of share with some of our listeners today, is to share a few of these kind of systems or processes that we can give players to help them individually to recover from their mistakes. So the first step to actually implementing that system is really to have them have this self-awareness of their own kind of self-talk. Now, you have done a really interesting activity with your team, Nate, where you've gotten them to kind of reflect on the way that they're talking to themselves.
Well, one of the things that we did, again, with that team that went from 2015 runner-up to 2016 state champions, we kind of followed up what we talked about last week with another activity that we sort of focused on what we called the voice of the abuser. And this is high school girls, okay? So we sort of presented them at the beginning of this conversation with, if you had a teammate or a friend that you knew was being verbally abused, that was being belittled and being sarcastic and torn down and, you know, all those kind of things. And we actually have used a video from YouTube in the past, just like, here's an example of somebody berating someone else in a restaurant. And so we talk with the team about what would you do for your friend if you knew she was in that situation, in a relationship where her boyfriend was doing things like that. And the kids would talk about, oh my gosh, we'd never allow that. And, you know, we'd talk about why. Why wouldn't you allow that? Why would you intervene? How would you go forward, you know, go about having that conversation? But what we're really driving toward isn't necessarily relationship health. It's the fact that this kind of voice is completely unacceptable for your friend in a romantic relationship. Why would you ever allow that same kind of voice to talk to you in your own mind? And, you know, when we do it with our team, it's sort of a mic drop moment in the room where it's like, oh. And our point is that they would never allow their friend to be talked to in that way. They would have enough self-respect that they wouldn't allow other people to talk to them in that way. And yet, that kind of inner monologue sometimes speaks to them in the same abusive manner and tone as what they would never tolerate from anybody else on the outside.
Yeah, I always have loved that kind of activity. I've seen some other coaches do it some similar ways where they're just really bringing awareness to the fact that we allow ourselves to talk to ourselves in a way that is not helpful, but it's actually incredibly harmful. And we think about the negative effects in that relationship, and you use that to draw and to really drive home this point of the way that we're talking to ourselves is really, really harmful, not just to our performance on the court or the field, but it's harmful to us as human beings and our emotional health.
So what we're going to share with you here this week are some strategies that you can share with your players, that you can teach your players to help them interrupt this voice of the abuser, to help get to the root of what causes bad body language on your team.
We're going to start with a short clip here from Sue Enquist. She's the 11-time national championship softball coach at UCLA, and she implemented this system with her team many years ago, and she called it the failure recovery system.
So I'm going to ask you to think about a fair recovery system in your own practice. For us, it was simply owning the moment, patting the chest, my bad, and calling two outs. Our failure recovery system was an actual routine that they learned. It became a station at practice. And I made the scenario harder for the team. So in our world, defense, you got to throw to a base and hit a receiver. Instead of just letting her stand there and have a lot of range to hit that target, I put them on a bucket. And you can't lift your butt off the bucket. Your throw has to be perfect. And it wasn't perfect. You missed it. Go through your routine, your failure recovery routine. And be a hornet as a leader that failure recovery is the key to sustainable excellence. Because we have one 100% control over it. Build a failure recovery system. Practice it. Practice the routine. Teach young student athletes that your chin must be up, your shoulders must be back. You must have eye contact and look at your teammate and go, "My bad, two outs, I got you." And get into your position. As opponent, you look over there and you see that kind of stability, it's intimidating. But we must teach them, put them in the environment where they're safe, execute it over time so it becomes natural. And yes, anybody that wants to learn that you're in a fast-paced sport, there's failure recovery systems that basketball teams are doing all over the country, and it's working. Because folks, excellence doesn't blink. Excellence does not wait for you to get rid of your junk. Excellence keeps moving. And that's what I love about the game. It won't wait for you to pull it together. So we must put that into our segments when we're training.
What I love about that bit from Sue is, first, she really comes back to this principle that we're going to rise and fall to the level of our training. And here she talks about this is something that they've trained. This isn't she gave an inspirational talk or she talks about toughness with her team. It's something that they actually have a drill or a station in practice, and then they have a very simple process to essentially normalize the mistakes. Right? Everyone's going to make mistakes, but what matters is how you respond. And let's talk about the appropriate way to respond, and then let's train it. And I think that this is so critical because so often in my experience as a coach in the past, I tried to get my players to be more mentally tough with talks, speeches, motivational videos, or articles. And none of that really ever brought about any lasting change within any of these players.
Well, JP, I think the other thing that Sue brings out in that piece is that a mistake response is entirely under the control of the individual athlete. And we've shared before there are things that you can do as a team to try to help them respond to that. But I think too often some players just assume that because of their temperament or their personality or because of who they are, they're just going to respond in a certain way. They're going to get frustrated. They're going to get fiery. They're going to be intense. And that intensity then spills over into how they respond. And they just say, "Well, that's who I am, coach," you know, and don't necessarily understand that you have control over not necessarily what you're feeling, but how you respond to that feeling. And certainly that you can control the script and the things that are going through your mind in those moments of crisis or failure.
Now, I think the important thing here is, you know, we don't have to do exactly what Sue Enquist did with her. You know, it doesn't have to be the same system. And there's some basic elements to her system, though, that we can shape for our sport and for the needs of our team.
And when you think about that, there essentially are three parts of what she shared there. The first part is the individual athlete. There has to be some sort of acknowledgement that a mistake was made, right? And so rather than try to deny it or rather than try to blame somebody else or whatever that might look like for your individual athlete, which could be different from player to player, there, step one is, I made a mistake. Now, step three is, in some way, the athlete needs to focus on what's important now. In other words, the next pitch or the next defensive stop or whatever is going to happen next in the game. We want them to be fully present in that moment and not lingering in the mistake that they just made. And that brings us back to step two, is there must be something that is a definitive break from I'm focused on my mistake for a quick second, and now I'm getting into the present moment. But what is that thing for that individual athlete that symbolizes the break into the next play? And that, again, could differ from player to player.
And I think step one is a really simple process. It's just, you know, putting your hand up. It's pointing to one of your teammates, like Sue talks about there, or just tapping your chest or whatever that is, and then making some eye contact with the players to let them know that, you know, there's just some sincerity in the fact that you've actually accepted responsibility for that mistake.
Well, I think one of the powerful things about making eye contact with your teammates after a mistake, which, again, that's a moment of vulnerability where players are more likely to look down or look somewhere else. Because if you make eye contact with somebody, there's always this fear of rejection, right? That they're going to look back with something that communicates you're not good enough for us. And so most of the time, players just deflect from being able to do that. But when they connect with eye contact and they perhaps share in the responsibility of for whatever play just happened, it's an opportunity for connection, which again is what they hope to bring into the next play. Now, in an individual sport situation, let's say in tennis or in golf, I think one of the other things that acknowledging the mistake does, it just helps to be able to accept your new reality. In other words, if you're playing golf and you're 90 yards from the green, a chip shot that you normally can make, and you blade one and it goes 30 yards over the green, you know, and now all of a sudden you're looking at an extra stroke at least, as you're walking toward that ball, just being able to acknowledge that I made that mistake and now I'm thinking about what happens next, rather than sometimes being stuck in this alternate reality of, I can't believe I did that, why didn't I just do this? You know, and your focus is on the shot that's already gone by, which prevents you from being able to get to the shot that lies in front of you. And sometimes that acknowledgement is just an acceptance of, I made a mistake, my reality has changed, and now I'm going to the next play.
So step two is the ritual that symbolizes the break from what happened to what will happen. And I actually had a little ritual that as a coach, when I would make a mistake, I started to go to the water cooler and just grab a quick drink of water there. And that was kind of the signal. And then I would come back to the bench and I would be locked in and start to focus on step three.
Well, there's a lot of different things that we've shared with our players when we've gone through this as a team in terms of having something symbolic to make that break. So some of our players prefer something physical to happen. Like Jimmy Connors, the great U.S. tennis player, when he would make a mistake, he used to pick at the strings on his racket and talk to himself a little bit. There are professional golfers that when they make a mistake, they'll pick up some blades of grass off the ground and they just throw it down. And the throwing of the grass sort of symbolizes, there goes my mistake. Now we're on to the next thing. A couple of our players this year, we had a player that would punch herself in the thigh, like not, you know, a roundhouse, but just a little jab at herself, and then she would move on. We had a couple of players that would just kind of scuff their sneaker on the floor. We had one player that she would tighten her ponytail just a little bit tighter, but there was something that was like a physical thing that happened that just helped them to make that break. Other players may have kind of a mental ritual. There may be something that, you know, they just say to themselves over and over or a couple times over that, you know, we can do this, we got the next one. And then they're immediately focused on the next thing. But having something that becomes a regular response as sort of the bridge into what happens next in that stage three is really critical for players to be able to move through their mistakes.
So I really like Sue Enquist's stage three here. She gets the players to yell out the number of outs in that inning. And I think that's what's great about that is you're getting players to focus on the controllables, the things about the process they need to have their focus and attention on. And so you could think of, and whatever your sport is, whether the number of timeouts that you have left, the defense that you're in, the person you're guarding, the time left in that quarter or that half of the game, whatever that is getting them to focus on something that's within their control is really powerful and moving past, you know, what had just happened.
I love a couple of the things that our friends at Point Guard College recommend in the aftermath of a mistake, similar to what you're talking about here, just giving reminders to your teammates, you know, who you're guarding or what defense we're in or time and situation. And another thing that Manawatsa talks about is animating in that moment. In other words, most players, after they make a mistake, their effort tends to go down. Their body language tends to be negative. And there's sort of this sapping of energy because they're stuck in their mistake. And instead, make a conscious effort to give more energy, to hustle even more in the next possession, whether that's on defense or running the floor or communicating or blocking out with extra intensity, that you can raise your level of energy to sort of feel like you're making up for that mistake as you're going into the next play.
Now, a really important piece of Sue Enquist's failure recovery system that wasn't kind of shared in that clip is this level of accountability, right? And it comes back to the very beginning of this episode where we talked about Geno's, you know, you're out of the game. Well, here, Sue Enquist has worked with the players. She's trained it. She's shown them the system for, you know, how they handle mistakes. Everything is within their control. And if a player chooses to not follow through on that, then they know they're going to be coming out of the game.
And in that regard, it's no different than anything else that you would teach your players in terms of their physical skills or expectations that you would have for them. You're still going to hold them accountable to what you've taught. Now, I think the last piece that is really important when it comes to mistake response of individual athletes is to really learn and embrace that a mistake or a failure is an opportunity to learn. And that isn't necessarily something that happens in the heat of competition after you make a turnover or miss a shot, but the reflection on your mistakes and embracing them as feedback, as simply saying, what I did there did not work. Now, what could I do differently next time? I think it disarms those mistakes in a way that players can learn to embrace them as something that can help them to get better. In other words, that as a coach, I don't look at somebody that made a mistake and that becomes a judgment on that player or a verdict on that person. It just becomes a teachable moment at some point that we need to learn how to do something better in that game context, and we can learn what that thing is from what just happened there.
I think one of the really powerful ways that we can be really intentional in kind of training that aspect is to just be intentional in our language. And I actually kind of don't like the whole idea of like calling it a failure recovery system. I much prefer a mistake recovery system, because I think when we hear failure, we think about success or failure, and it's much, much more tied in people's minds to their identity. And we want to think a mistake is just something that's very temporary, and that success is really determined on our response to the mistake. And I think that's just something, just by being intentional with our language, we can help to train athletes to have more of that kind of that growth mindset.
And this is certainly something that can be modeled as coaches too. You know, one of the most common phrases that our players have heard over the years in the gym is, that's bad coaching. When I try to set up a drill and it doesn't work, when I try to, you know, put in a scheme and they don't get it, like, I take responsibility for that in the same way that what we're talking about here, individual athletes should do. That's bad coaching, right? And there are times when we make adjustments during the year, we try something different, where I'll explain to the players, we did it this way. I made this decision and it didn't work, but here's what I learned from that, and now here's what we're going to do moving forward. And I think the more that you can walk through that as a coach, the again, modeling that vulnerability and the way that you respond to those mistakes and embracing them as an opportunity for feedback, it makes it more likely that players will be able to do the same.
If this topic really interests you, I'd encourage you to check out episode 28 of Coaching Culture, where we have Trevor Reagan from TrainUgly.com on there. And he really goes into the science of just how important it is that we create an environment where people feel safe to make mistakes. And for some coaches, I think, I know personally myself, we want everything to go perfect in practice. We don't want there to be balls flying over there. We don't want like mistakes, because we feel like that's a sign of good coaching and things are going well. But and Trevor really dives into this idea that you want to train ugly. You want a lot of mistakes, but that's where you're going to learn. And so it's a really, really good episode worth checking out. Lastly, if you find the strategies and systems that we discuss on the podcast to be valuable, I'd encourage you to check out my book, Calling Up, Discovering Your Journey to Transformational Leadership. Have a few chapters in there that go beyond some of these strategies on really how to build a culture where people feel safe to make mistakes and really empower them to learn and grow from those mistakes. So you can get that book at thriveonchallenge.com.